Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next interview is with Benjamin Gilmore and Sam Smith, two guys who came together to make a really compelling, interesting, funny, and relevant film called Jirga. It's a film that was made out of Australia, but largely made in Afghanistan with local people. It's rooted in context. It's rooted in the culture. And the story that you're going to hear actually in the interview of how they got the film made, how it went from a production that was supposed to be made in Pakistan to ending up in Afghanistan, is a story in itself. It's too bad they didn't have another crew shooting that. They could have had a pretty interesting doc on their hands. We talk about redemption and wartime. We talk about making mistakes and responsibility and choice and perspectives and moral courage and being authentic. And Sam and Benjamin clearly are having a good time talking about the film, but my guess is, as challenging as it was, they had a pretty good time while they were making it as well. We talk about ethics and trauma and about the suffering in silence and how this soldier, this man is convicted enough to pack his bags and come back into a country that he spent time oppressing and invading and seek out forgiveness and redemption. It's a delightful film, Jirga. Gorgeous cinematography, gorgeous photography itself, the landscape, the images that you're going to see will stay with you for a long time. It's also the Sam's performance is wonderful. So check it out, Jirga. Hope it's coming soon to a theater near you, and if it's not, look for it somewhere, video on demand. I'm sure it's going to be available soon. Jirga, J-I-R-G-A, Benjamin Gilmore. And Sam Smith coming right up, davidpecklive.com for more information about my speaking and writing. And, of course, face-to-facelive.ca for many more interviews coming out of TIFF this year and a few interesting and compelling authors coming up as well. Look for an interview, The Dissident Doctor, coming soon to Face to Face Live as well with Dr. Michael Klein. And what else? Yeah, I just wanted to say, too, if you have the time, certainly I'd love your financial support through patreon.com if you're supportive and get behind what we're doing here. But also, if you would take the time to write a review for me, if you're enjoying the interviews, if they're challenging you in some new and interesting way, I hope you'll take the time to put in a review for me on Apple. I would appreciate it. Coming right up, Benjamin Gilmore, Sam Smith, talking about their new, delightful new film, Jirga. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by two very special guests here with us today. Toronto Film Festival, I don't know, this is interview 32 and a half, I think. It's been a busy, 3 days in. It's been a little crazy, and the crowds have been great. And you guys are just in from Australia, in Paris. Sam Smith, Benjamin Gilmore here today to talk about their new film, Jurga. Thanks, guys, for joining me.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
So are you pumped up on wake-up pills? Is that I hope so. And if not, maybe we can get you.
I've been traveling for like a month, so I'm like all over. I was in Italy for a while, then Paris, and now I'm here. So I'm just kind of like rolling with it, drinking lots of coffee, and that's it.
You know? Lots of coffee. Stay hydrated.
Yeah.
Keep smiling if you can.
Just the thrill of being here, I mean, you know, at this festival.
So is this Jurga, before we dive in, I mean, we're already in, I suppose. International world, you've already won some awards with this film, I think, haven't you?
In Australia, in our own country, yeah. It's quite surprising. Last week, Australia's biggest film prize, Cinefest Oz, and you know, this small Aussie film took out that award. So we were quite pleased about that.
Yeah, we didn't know. Coming back from Afghanistan with the footage, we didn't even know if we had enough footage to make a film. So.
Wow.
And we had no producer at that time or anything, so we just had footage.
So I'm kind of of two minds, and I'm sure we're going to get into all of it. I mean, there's so many issues. There was a recent critical review of the film that we should talk about, because it brings up something about white guilt, which is certainly, or the white man's burden, I guess you could say, as William Easterly calls it, you know, the development writer. We could talk some about that, but I'd love to hear a little bit about the challenges you guys had on this one, because this is pretty unique just in the making of it. Well, obviously, the story is remarkable in its own right. But tell me about the craziness around Pakistan, Afghanistan, budget, where you shot at, you know, how many days did you spend in jail? These are important questions.
Well, just very briefly to get us to Afghanistan, we met up and discussed the film in Sydney after I got approached by a Pakistani businessman who was going to put up money, and like any filmmaker who gets approached by a money man.
Gold mine, yes. Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a kind of an offer too good to be true sometimes, as it was in our case. But you know, in a sense, I was in denial about those things that I felt weren't quite right about this offer. And in any case, it got us over to Pakistan. And once we arrived in Islamabad, we realized that everything wasn't quite as it seemed. And the businessman hadn't got the adequate approvals from the Secret Service. And nothing happens in that country without their blessing. And so he pulled his money out when they said they weren't going to support the film. That's when we were left with very little budget.
Do you think, I mean, sometimes it's just bureaucracy, it's administration and so on. It happens anywhere in the world, it seems to me. The long lineups is a metaphor. They happen everywhere. But was it more political than that, do you think? Was there a reason?
They said it was too politically sensitive, and funnily enough, there wasn't enough romance.
That
was one of the strange comments.
Needs to be more kissing.
I'm
willing to support a film with lots of kissing.
But if you look closely at the film, there is a type of romance there, a bromance.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's a lovely relationship that develops.
About that relationship between these central male characters, which is really lovely. But yeah, I mean, I think once they decide not to support you, at one point they even tried to convince us to work for them in their propaganda wing. So we're talking about the Inter-Services Intelligence, the ISPR, and they're extremely powerful. They are the biggest film producers in Pakistan at the moment. They have an incredible inventory of equipment, and they make these blockbuster films, usually very formulaic and pretty much the same story of the Pakistan army fighting the militants. And
I can't believe you didn't bend towards that kind of access, that kind of funding. Isn't that like every filmmaker's dream?
I've got principles. You've got to remember this.
That's right.
This mob are the ones accused of, you know.
I'm happy to make a little propaganda if it gets my film made.
I mean, I've had a lot of, you know, bad feelings towards the ISI for their, you know, for their treatment of some of my friends in the tribal areas. The Pashtuns have been treating very, very badly over the years with their incursions and control of Waziristan and their support for the Taliban, and, you know, their being suspected of being behind a lot of false flag operations and harboring Bin Laden and so on and so forth. So they're very powerful, but also very dodgy. I didn't want to be involved with them. I was very uncomfortable.
Well, I bet, and that kind of comes through to me, at least. There's a tone in the film that comes through that you know, I couldn't help but being taken out every now and then, thinking this must have been a little crazy to shoot. Now, I knew that you were either in Pakistan or Afghanistan, but I wasn't sure exactly when and where, but there was just this sense of urgency within it. And was that palpable for you, Sam?
Very much. Yeah, that's what I made.
I mean, I immediately go to that scene where you're split up from your driver, and you're coming down with your bag down the side of the mountain.
No, it was very. I mean, that it was kind of sketchy from the start, because we had that happen in Pakistan, obviously, where the funding fell through, and then we had all the permits blocked. Because as soon as that happened, the backer said, "Oh, cool, I'm out. I can't be a part of this." We then found out that there were files created on us, and we also it gets
so
better.
Photographs we were, exist.
Well, yeah. No, we were also being tailed, though. We were like being followed by people. It's like being in a 70s spy movie over there. Like, we had guys literally popping up out of bushes when we went to get our Afghan visas. We had guys pretending to be beggars at traffic lights, and then our driver would say, "That's actually a guy who works the ISI. This is his spot." You know, so we had a lot of that stuff, and Ben and I were sort of in a situation where Ben said to me, "Okay, cool, we can either go home with nothing, or you and I can now go to Afghanistan with no funding, rewrite the script together, and basically wing it." You know, so that was the plan B. And he had the contacts of two people over there to contact when we got there, not like, you know, let's set it up beforehand. And so we went down that road.
Yeah, so this is like every budding new film. Every filmmaker should, never mind budding new filmmaker, should listen to this conversation.
Straight over to Afghanistan. This is how you get a film.
That's right. Yeah, the tax credits alone are going to make you rich beyond your wildest dreams. Yeah. So huge challenges, clearly. Did that now, you know, you say, let's rewrite the script. Did that change everything?
Yeah.
Well, it changed a lot. Changed a lot of scenes that we'd planned that were quite extravagant, and the script kind of was stripped right back to its core elements.
Through line was
there, and certainly the second half of the film remains very, very close to what it was in the draft we had at the time. But you know what we learned, and what I've learned on previous guerrilla film shoots of this kind, is that you need to adapt. It's a dynamic thing. You need to be open to the changes that come your way, and because they're also more often than not full of positive surprises.
Yeah. Well, we also found too that every time we thought this is the worst possible thing that happened, such as funding gets pulled out in Pakistan, it turned out to be the best thing. You know, because having that happen meant we shot it in a more authentic location. Then we come back and we have no producer attached. We get a great, very respected Australian and international producer, John Maynard, comes on board. Do you know what I mean? So things that at the time were the worst possible thing meant that we had to adapt. And when we did, some new thing blossomed.
Well, it's kind of interesting. It's kind of risk management, isn't it? A little bit? Because in risk management, what if, but what then? Because what is a risk and what is an issue and a problem often can turn into an opportunity.
And you only see that afterwards. Yeah. You know,
gifts. See it afterwards. Yeah. You got to dive in. Yeah. You got to dive in. Hey, let's go to Afghanistan and make this with probably very little funding.
Very little money left. Yeah, there was some savings, some crowdfunding, a little bit of Screen Australia development funding. There was hardly any left, and a lot of that went to
the craft budget. Was a lot of
camera.
Was it spent on a lot of rice? Basically, that was all you could afford. Yeah, rice and a little broth.
Yeah, and you know, and that was a luxury. But
that was a luxury.
Yeah. We had that on Fridays. Yeah.
Yes. The occasional egg. Yeah.
But you know, I mean, it is true to say that we were out to make something authentic about this country and its people.
Well,
and for us not to shoot there in the first place, you know, was not, you know, sincere enough.
Yeah,
and
Benjamin, you nailed it. As far as I'm concerned, for what it's worth, it's authentic, it's real, it's not in your face. And by the way, I love the film. And congratulations and thanks. I mean, for making it, and I hope everyone sees it, because there's any great film, isn't it the case that there's always more going on than meets the eye?
Well, in this case, while shooting Jirga, there was a parallel story for us.
Yeah.
And if you actually look at the timeline of what happened, of us going to Pakistan and being let down by our backer over there, and then having to go out on a limb on our own, you know, further into the woods, so to speak. It's very similar to what was happening in the film for the protagonist, Mike, the veteran, the former soldier, Australian soldier, going back, meeting up with an ex-Afghan army colonel who he thought was going to help him, and then being told, no, your mission's crazy, don't do it, they'll kill you.
I love the fact that it's an ex-German
a general who's saying the mission's too dangerous, right? Either he's, not that courageous, or maybe just it really is completely crazy, C. So you're Mike. You give us a tiny bit of context out of the gate with through night vision goggles, I believe, that you're setting the scene. Your facial expressions lead me to believe you made a pretty big mistake. Can you talk a bit about that as the actor, but also as... I don't know, as Sam, the actor, but as Mike, the character.
I've never served in the military, so I'm speaking purely from speaking to people in the military and from my own experience of what they've told me and imagining, I guess, and going into that headspace. But I can imagine that it'd be very easy to make that mistake. If you're in a situation where it's so heightened, it's at night and you think there's an enemy threat and you turn and someone pops out of the doorway, I can understand how you might just blow them away because you're in a very heightened state and possibly fearing for your own life, So I think it'd be very easy to make that mistake. And I think it would also depend on the type of person you are after that, on how you process that and deal with it. Because I spoke to three different guys who had served in the Australian Army, and they all had very different perspectives on what it was like to take a life, because they'd all taken a life. One guy was point blank, I have no issue with it. It was him or me, and I sleep well.
I'm not sure I believe him.
Okay,
I hear that, but good for him if that's true, but wow.
That may also just be the way that he's processing that cool, I'll put it in that box. I spoke to another guy who said it sat with me for a very long time, and it still does. I know for myself, I can speak that if I was in that situation, I dare say I'd be on that side. I'd have a lot of trouble knowing that I'd done that, so I think that the...
So you resonated with the character as well.
Absolutely, I have trouble killing mosquitoes. I'm not very good with taking life.
I can help you with that. Yeah. There are chemicals for that.
So
I had a great, rich conversation with somebody recently about whether or not the world would still exist this way if we could completely eradicate mosquitoes. Like, would there be a problem if we wiped them out entirely? Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's a problem if we take the ecosystem.
Northern Ontario? Deadly for mosquitoes. Yeah. We just don't have to worry about, dengue and malaria and Japanese encephalitis. But anyway, yeah. So did you find yourself, you made a comment about going back into the woods, and it's kind of funny to me that you use that phrase, because there's really very few trees where you guys were. The landscape, character, beautiful. Beautiful, contradictory, paradoxical with all that's gone on in the world. And, oh, and by the way, the we got to talk about the paddle boat. We'll come back to that in a second. Did that situate you in a way that did you ever lose perspective? Were you Mike?
Oh man, I was in some pretty crazy headspaces. I mean, there was a period when we arrived in Jalalabad where we were staying at a hotel. It was, I think, a 200 person hotel, and I think we saw four people there over the time we were there. And it's
because it was empty.
Yeah,
that's creepy.
So The Shining to me, And actually, when we got there, there were two twin girls, aged like four, in little outfits at the counter. I just looked at him and I was like, "Fuck, man, where are we?"
The night clerk looks suspiciously like Stanley Kubrick. We're not sure why, but
when we stayed there, that was we arrived in Jalalabad the day that Kerry Wilson, Australian
aid worker from Perth, who was, just checked out of that hotel
and was kidnapped the day that we arrived. There, and so we're staying. I was already I haven't traveled to that part of the world before, so I was on high alert most of the time we were there, But when we were staying there, we were staying in a hotel where there was a broken lock on my door. We would wake up to a mortar blast or machine gun fire. I was sleeping probably during the sequence when we were shooting in the caves. I was sleeping maybe 3 hours a night, and then shooting long days, coming back and thinking, and I was definitely in a strange place. I was waking up at 2 a.m. putting a chair in front of the door and sitting with a knife, waiting for the dawn prayer, I was sleeping fully clothed, passport, knife in my hand under the pillow. I was really...
And as the director, I was concerned about...
Of course,
this,
I guess. It probably could add to the character and the storytelling.
But, there's struggle between the authenticity that comes from that and also your obligation, your duty of care that you have to an actor. But I wanted to check on Sam on numerous occasions, particularly at night. But I knew that if I walked in on him at 4 a.m. to check whether he was okay, because we were hearing gunfire uncomfortably close, I was concerned what would happen to me, as I went into the room. Mm. So there was always that. Yeah, it was kind of, you know, that kind of a Captain Willard from Apocalypse Now kind of situation in Sam's room, I must say, at times.
So Apocalypse Now, The Shining. Okay, we got to get a more cheery a reference in here, I think. Yeah, great references, but a little concerning, I think. There's something really simple about the film, and I mean that in the best sense of the word, you know, stark, pithy, not in your face, but clear and concise. This is a, and I think somebody, there's been a critique of the film that it's really, and maybe this is unfair of the critique of the critique, but it's about white men's guilt. Mm. Well, it seems to me guilt is kind of a pretty simple thing in some regards. Mm. It hones in us. Now, what do we do with it? Mm. Mike does something with it.
He does. Mm.
Guilt led him to some kind of conviction, and the conviction led him to action that kind of changes me as a viewer, my perspective on forgiveness, and or at least starts makes me ask new questions. I mean, did you guys have that sense going in? Is that was that okay? This is exactly what we want to happen. This is a story about redemption. This is a story.
I was very interested in the idea of moral courage as opposed to physical courage. So you know, here's a soldier who is suffering, has this guilt. Also understands that the Afghans, you know, have suffered because of the war terribly as well, and wants to do something about that guilt, and doesn't just sit with that. You know, I think we've got a lot of veterans who are suffering in silence and with no recourse, no way of coming to terms or healing. And we also have Afghans and Afghan culture that is really open to reconciliation, and so you've got this situation where peace and harmony and reconciliation is really achievable, but unfortunately I haven't yet heard of a story like this where a soldier takes that step to that extent of tracking down the family of someone that he's killed and presenting himself for you know, in front of the justice system of the village.
Well, I think I haven't served in the military. You're a paramedic, aren't you?
Paramedic.
Yes.
I mean, there are a few little similarities between
sure.
You know, that that sort of companionship you have with your fellow paramedics.
Yeah, you're all heavy drinkers, right?
No.
yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah.
I was talking more about the bond that we have.
Yeah, for sure.
When you bear witness to and you're involved in, you know, really terrible things, and you see people killed and dying, and you know, you bear witness to that together. You share.
There's a courage. Something. There's a sense of urgency. There's a threat. It seems to me in that kind of work.
And I've also worked with paramedics who were formerly in the military, and also treated patients who are returned soldiers.
Is there a sense that and Sam, maybe you can help me out here too? But and where I was going with that was. I'm a soldier, therefore I'm allowed to do these things. And the one soldier you talked to who said, oh, you know, I sleep well at night, right? Perhaps that's how, because it's sanctioned, right? It's government. It's my job. Mm. You know, I ended up killing some people.
You're trained to kill and destroy.
You're trained to kill and destroy.
I think I understand that. But at the same time, you can put a label on anyone. You can say, I'm a soldier, I'm a teacher, I'm an artist, I'm whatever. Underneath that, you're always a human being. So,
nice. Yep.
Do you know, I think it comes down to an ethical code, which is either in you or you're taught it or whatever, wherever it comes from. But yeah, I think it's very easy to compartmentalize something by saying someone said it's okay, I'm allowed to do it, so that's fine. But it's a different thing when you wake up in the middle of the night thinking about your actions over the course of your life and whether you're okay with them. You know, I think it's a very different conversation you have.
I think what I love about a film like yours, the minimalist sort of approach, is the questions for me that it raises.
Uh-huh.
What compel? It's not just guilt that got Mike to Afghanistan. There were some other things going on. I want to see some of those conversations you had before you left. I want to hear about those sleepless nights from your partner, from your friends, from your family, the conversations that you had. Mm. What is it that led up to this? So it's 3 years basically since I think you the accident, the killing.
Yeah.
And you've come back 3 years later to find seems really soon after to me in a way, and yet really long as well. What's gone on in those 3 years?
I think it's 3 years of trying to come to terms with something and finding that you can't. You know, if you've done something that you sit if you can't sit with yourself morally as a human being and look at yourself in the mirror in the morning and decide, yes, I'm okay with who I am, then some people will, yeah, sure, endure that for a much longer time. Maybe they'll go to the grave with that. But I think other people will go, I actually have to address this for myself for a number of other reasons, but even just so I can get up in the morning and go, I'm okay with who I am, you know?
I think you've talked around trauma, it seems to me, post-traumatic stress disorder, mental health issues of one kind or another. How do we deal with those things? And if we sweep them under the carpet, what then? Mm. What damage are we doing to the communities we live in, to the families we live within, and so on? And there's this repercussion. I mean, it's called a lot of work now being done on transgenerational trauma. You know, Afghanistan, yes, of course, but what about the soldiers that were there present? What are they passing on to their kids and their families?
There's a lot of damage there, and unfortunately and tragically a lot of former soldiers who have been suffering these emotional injuries feel as if there's no way out from that pain, and in some cases that guilt. They feel like they're in a corner and have felt that there's no way out but to take their own lives. And that's why we've got a criminally high suicide rate among veterans in America and certainly in Australia. I mean, which is, and I think sometimes that, that despair that precedes such a drastic decision that some of these veterans take, that despair, I would just love to say that, there are ways to get through this. And, whether it's exposure therapy, there's a whole lot of, new developments, around post-traumatic stress and other. But also the idea that you could go back, actually physically go back to that place and to have a different experience there, which is essentially what exposure therapy tries to do.
Well, it makes me wonder about narrative therapy and things like art therapy, things, not sitting on that Freudian kind of sitting in a couch having a conversation. Sure, the conversation's important and so on, but what I love about what you guys have done here is that healing is to be found in others. Mm-hmm. Healing is to be found in that other culture that I invaded.
By connecting with them.
And you do that so beautifully with the driver. By the way, is that cigarette? Did he make that cigarette out of charcoal?
That's not a cigarette.
That's hashish.
Oh, I thought that was. I'm sorry.
They warm up. Warms up and softens the hash.
When he reached down, I thought he was picking out the ash, and I totally missed that.
Warms up the hash and then kind of kneads it a bit to soften it, and then breaks it up and mixes it with the tobacco, and then puts it in the hash cigarette.
Did you write in the percussion stuff, or did that just kind of tease out
that
percussionist
in the film, Mike. The former soldier and his taxi driver, who was initially quite suspicious of Mike's motives for returning to the country, bond on a mountaintop over a fire that they've built together and a meal they've had together and music
and sharing a meal together,
and they don't share common language apart from music.
This to me is the new pathway towards reconciliation.
While shooting it. It became very apparent that Mike represented the West, and Sher Alam, the taxi driver, Afghanistan, and how peace can be possible if we take the time to authentically engage and to listen and to approach each other, unarmed and vulnerable and just really, really openly, and meet as humans and look each other in the eye. It all sounds very...
Sounds idealistic.
Idealistic.
But even if it's not true, I think we have to hope that it is true.
Absolutely. Yeah. What have we got if we don't have idealism, I'd say? We have cynicism. We have a world that's just going to exist in this kind of with this kind of hopelessness. Mm. And, I've seen a lot of, death and suffering and misery and, pain in my job over 20 years as a paramedic. It'd be very easy to become cynical about that. But the moment you become cynical, you kind of lose any passion for creating a better world and for change. So I've always tried to hold on to idealism. Even risking accusations of being naive, because I believe that the moment you trade that, the moment you give that up, we've got no hope as a human race.
There's a great scene. Love that stuff. It sounds to me you should be behind a podium and should be speaking to a couple thousand people. Honestly, this is why I love storytelling. Why I love film. The unexpected outcomes of great stories. The forgiveness comes quickly, it seems, in the end scene. Now, obviously, there was interaction there. There were probably some meals shared, things that we don't get to see, and there's reasons for that. I would imagine that are practical, but also part of the story as well. You mentioned earlier, I think, that you felt that the Afghani culture is very open to this idea of reconciliation. Can you talk a little bit more about that and why you felt that and how it is that you came to know that? And it makes sense. Of course, it would make sense, right? But I find it interesting that you brought it up earlier too.
My experience of Afghanistan is obviously largely based on me going there with Ben and making this film. I don't have like a grand knowledge of, I know the basic history, you know what I mean? But I'm
sure.
But yep. My experience of the place was based on the people I met and how they treated me. So when we would go into a village and we were welcomed by the village Malik and welcomed by people who have very little but wanted to give you everything they could.
Right, right.
That was my experience of Afghanistan. It wasn't sort of the Fox News version where it's guys popping out of bushes, which, obviously is there too. But when you meet the everyday man there, they're just trying to live like we are,
Yeah, we're aren't we just kind of all in this together?
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely, we are. And in terms of the Afghan culture and their tribal codes, particularly the Pashtun tribal code of Pakhtunkhwali, which they live by, forgiveness and reconciliation play a big role in that tribal code.
That comes out in that one sentence, if someone asks for it.
Yeah, and it's the tenet is called Nanawati. And Nanawati is the principle of Nanawati is that if your enemy or someone who has harmed you, an offender, comes to your door and unarmed and to make peace and apologize genuinely, then you're obliged within that tribal culture to not only forgive but to make that individual welcome and to treat them as if they're part of your own tribe.
There's a beautiful scene near the beginning of the film, and it takes place in the bird market, I believe. Mm. Was that a really conscious decision? And if so, is there any kind of a metaphorical reason for that? Because I thought it was lovely for a lot of reasons.
Thanks for saying so, but that place does exist in Kabul. The bird market is a very atmospheric and magical place, and it's just beautiful. And I think cinema allows you an opportunity, a broad canvas to use, and surround sound to use.
You certainly approach that in the film with the landscapes,
yeah,
and the water that seems to just kind of come out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. It looks fake.
Yeah,
it's
because it's so associate with Afghanistan.
No.
It's yeah. Beautiful. That country is
not the swan, pink swan paddle boat either. I don't associate that with Afghanistan either. I love that scene.
Yeah,
the reason I asked about the birds is because for me, I've done a lot of traveling and work in Southeast Asia, and there's bird markets, birds where you can purchase a bird and release it. And right. I don't remember what the exact. Well, I mean, we could talk about all kinds of different metaphors of that, but I just. That's where I went.
Yeah, Afghans are very, very. The birds are a passion for Afghans, as are roses, and they keep birds as pets. It's a very common thing in the city. But for me, it was that location that was just so magical, and the possibilities of how that would look and sound in a cinema. You got the opportunity for surround sound, so you just hear this variety of bird call all around you when you're sitting in that. In the cinema, it's just a really magical.
Were you guys place. Really aware of representing this culture that you were privileged enough to step into in a really, and it, I think it's a, I can hear you just saying yes, but I'd love you to chat a bit about that. The treating others with dignity, honoring this, the cross-cultural awareness. Mm. That you talked about, Benjamin, about listening. I'm in development, as my listeners know, and I've taught development for about 10 years. And one of the things I say, there's three, you've heard this before, guys, but there's three things for a good development worker. The first thing is you got to listen. And the second thing is you got to, oh yeah, right, listen. And the third thing is you got to listen. Right?
Well, I think it's where we've gone wrong in Afghanistan.
Well, so many places.
In so many other places.
And in relationships.
Yeah. Yeah.
In politics, right?
Yeah,
I think.
Absolutely. You know, this idea that we can go there and impose our ideas on a country, impose our version of democracy on a country when they have an age-old 1,000-2,000-year history.
Right. The arrogance of that, right?
Of, you know, of this Jirga system. So Jirga refers to a group of village elders who get together and discuss a matter as a village justice system. That's 2,000 years old. Everyone has equal say around the, you know, around the circle of this meeting, and they go to a vote. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, democratic features to the Jirga.
Sure. Yeah,
and yet we want to impose our system that has been shown in Afghanistan to be so open to corruption, and that's why it's failed and people have gone back to their Jirgas, you know, which I find interesting. But the whole idea of listening.
And again, based in community, based in relationship.
When we went to Afghanistan, we went there to make a film. We arrived unarmed and you know, in civilian clothes and ready to listen and collaborate with the locals.
Come alongside.
Right. And to help them share their story of the world. Essentially, as you know, I saw myself and Sam and I as messengers that were going there to bring back a story that we could share that Afghans didn't have the opportunity, or certainly the Afghans that we were meeting with didn't have the opportunity to share with the world. So, you know, in a sense, you could say that, you know, it had the international community, in regards to the war that's been, we're now in our 17th year, you know, taken a similar approach of authentically engaging without this kind of aggressive military campaign, we may have been a lot more successful, and the war could have concluded a decade ago.
Yeah, and I forget who the quote is, and I should know this, but you know, we're destined to repeat history, right? If we don't know it, but the reality is, we seem to repeat it anyway.
Yes, even if,
or at least at least the 20th century certainly has shown that. Let's hope that is changing and that's shifting. And what I love about what you guys have done is, and I'm so glad you did persevere. And I think that comes out not only in you as a director and co-writers, but you as an actor and the character of Mike as well. This sense of being on his own and still fighting back, and in his own against his personal demons and knowing there's something better.
Yeah.
And that's profoundly courageous, it seems to me, to be able to say I'm gonna hope that we can get here, and then take the steps to try to make it so. It's quite remarkable. What do you think you're going to be able to, as an actor, do you think you're going to be able to top this experience? I will forever remember your description of you sitting in front of the unlocked door, fully dressed, on two hours of sleep.
Definitely not in the trailer on this one.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny though, because prior to having the audition for this, I was actually looking at a painting of, I think it was like a village in Afghanistan. It was like a very old picture, and I was looking at it and thinking to myself, oh, I'd love to see that part of the world, but I bet you I'll never get a chance because of how things are.
Right.
And
right.
Then I got this audition, and I thought, that's quite fortuitous, you know, and then
and
did it. But the other thing is that I actually really love films that were made in that kind of the 70s, where it is a bit more, probably not to this degree, but it's a bit more guerrilla, and there's not so much red tape, where because there's, you know, someone eating with a knife and fork at the table, there's a first aid guy with a pack of band-aids ready, you know.
Right.
I mean, like,
yes.
I love it when you see films where you see that something's happened and they have to go with what might be a mistake or something just occurring, life occurring, and you have to go with it. And we sort of had nothing but that from this whole thing, where we just had to run with whatever was happening, and sometimes we get one take. Do you know what I mean?
So yeah,
for me, it was a real, I loved the experience in that sense. It was very scary at other times, you know, obviously, but the process of the filmmaking within it, I loved.
Documentary element that came
it's
through.
It's got a docudrama kind of feel to it, for sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you talk about those lines being blurred in the film between drama and documentary, but we actually shot this film, many parts of this film, like you would shoot a documentary. And I'm really fascinated. I love that. I mean, it wasn't because we were necessarily forced into that situation because of our circumstances, which was certainly, you know, part of it.
Sure.
But it's a deliberate thing that I'm interested in doing as a director, is to create a situation and let it play out as it really would.
Mm.
You know, you can't write that stuff.
Didn't know that I was an actor. They thought I was a soldier. The Jerga, like, a few people were confused and thought I was a soldier.
You were actually a soldier. Yeah. You got a little bit of a military thing going on.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, I think so. Either that or a professional wrestler. I'm not sure what it is. But guys, listen.
A bit light on, but yeah.
That's right. Thanks so much for joining me today. I always hate it when I have to wrap up an interview, because it just there's so much more to talk about. I feel like we barely
talked for the rest
surface.
Of the day.
Absolutely. Yeah, and maybe we can. Maybe I can track you both down on Skype down the road, and we can go a little deeper. But I love the film. Hope everybody sees it. Thanks for coming and for entertaining the conversation this morning on such little sleep. But you're used to it, Mike. So it's I'm glad you're not holding a knife in your hand today.
I'm not threatening.
That's right. Talking to Benjamin Gilmore and Sam Smith about their new film Jerga. You need to go and see this film. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.